This podcast was recorded on the date indicated with the link. The views and opinions expressed herein are as of the date recorded and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities. Such views and opinions may differ from those of DoubleLine Capital or its affiliates and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide updates or changes. Welcome to Monday Morning Minutes, hosted by DoubleLine's fixed income asset allocation strategists and portfolio managers, Samuel Lau and Jeffrey Mayberry. Please direct any comments and suggestions to minutes@doubleline.com or see us on Twitter at DLineMinutes.
Welcome to this week's episode of DoubleLine Monday Morning Minutes. I'm Jeff Mayberry here with Sam Lau. We're recording early today for some scheduling conflicts on Friday, April 29th. Last night was the first round in the NFL draft, also known as the high point of the season for some teams, specifically Mark Kimbrough's team, high point of the season. And we get a few more rounds this afternoon.
Yeah, I didn't watch it, as I never do, but I did see the chatter pick up across a number of my little chat groups on my phone here. So I just ignored those, but just caught the bits and pieces.
Yeah, but it's in Vegas. And so it kind of made me a little bit pine to head back there sometime soon.
Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. It'll probably come true.
Yeah, right. All right, let's get into it's been a kind of a crazy month. And so why don't we get into where are we, kind of highlighting the week and the month, since it is the last business day of April.
Yeah. It's been a tough month, beyond just crazy. It's been a rough month. We're looking at the S&P 500 is down about 1.5% at the time of recording right now. But on the month to date, it's down 7%, and on the year to date, it's down almost 11.5%. And really, looking at the sector that's been driving some of this weakness, at least just from an absolute return basis, is comm services. They're down almost 12% month to date. And it's also the worst performer on the year to date basis, down almost 22%. So definitely some tough times for that sector. The market, it's had some a little rougher start to the year, or the first quarter earnings as well, for some of the constituents within there. On the other end of the book, on the other side of the spectrum there, in terms of month-to-date, the best performer, it's consumer staples. On a year-to-date basis, the best performer is still the energy sector. I'll just point out, too, that alongside consumer staples, the only other positive contributor month-to-date is the energy sector, but that's up about 10 basis points or so right now. And then moving across the board, looks like no real differentiation on the month, at least, between the small cap represented by the Russell 2000 and then the large caps as measured by the Russell 1000. They're down each about around 7% on a month-to-date basis. With regards to growth versus value, the 1000 growth is down almost 10% on a month-to-date basis. Through today, and Russell 1000 is down almost 4%. So a big divergence there that we're seeing. And it leads into kind of resembling what's going on a year-to-date basis as well. Russell growth is down 18% on that window of time, and the value sector is down about 4.5% over the same time frame.
And looking at, we don't normally talk about the NASDAQ, but it's down 19 and change year-to-date. So I guess it's almost a bear market. I guess, I don't know. It was probably up, and it's probably peak to trough, down 20%, just like a communication services in a bear market. If you want to look at sector type bear markets and use the nice round 20% number, which, it's just a made up number anyway, but it pretty much looks like almost like a bloodbath across all equity markets.
That's right. And we've just seen, as we've talked about also, throughout this year, is just we've seen a little bit of the reversal from some of the leaders now become the laggards in terms of those sectors there. So
moving across. So the ones that benefited from the quantitative easing are now getting hurt from the QT.
Yeah, or as
potential, we potential QT, I guess.
Yeah. So let's see what May the 4th has to do with their like to call it there. In fixed income land on the month basis, let's just talk about where the yields are right now. So on the 2-year yield, we're at 2.72%, up 38 basis points in yield on the month. The 10-year is at 2.9, up 56 basis points on the month for the yield. And the long bond is at 2.96, up about 50 basis points or so. And with that, looking at the differential between the 10-year yield and the 2-year yield, it's at 18 basis points right now. And just at the screen right here, it looks like the previous quarter end, which was the month end of March, the yield curve was at zero, unless you want to round. I mean, that's with a little bit of a round. It was actually slightly below, but I'm seeing a 0.00 right here. So I'm not going to expand out those decimal points on that one. In terms of the Bloomberg U.S. bond aggregate, looking right now on a week-to-date basis, it may pull out a slightly positive week. I see it's up 4 basis points right now. Month-to-date down 3.7. And year to date down just over 9%. So definitely a rough go across both equity markets, US equity markets, as well as the US bond aggregate as well. Within there, the duration based, the more interest rate sensitive sectors are performing the worst. IG corporate credit is down 6.5% on the month and down over 14% on the year. Looking at treasuries, it's down about 3% on the month, down over 9% on the year. And then we have agency mortgage-backed securities somewhere in between, with the performance of down 35 on a month-to-date basis and down 8.2% year-to-date. So definitely a rough go across all of your more traditional asset classes, let's say. So, you know, we've pointed this out in the past that the 60-40 portfolio, if you had just been invested in that and using the S&P 500 and the Bloomberg aggregate as your components there, then you would be off to the worst start to the year going back to 1988.
And if you rebalance that at the end of the year, you'd be down 10.5 or so. So it's not a good sign when your bond portfolio and your stock portfolio are vying for which can be the worst performer over you know, the year to date, where, you know, ag's down 9 and change, S&P down 11 and change. So usually you want those kind of moving in opposite directions.
That's right. So that brings us to the next sector or asset class that we tend to look at, and that's commodities. And we always talk about the diversification benefits that commodities can bring the portfolio, but the Bloomberg Commodity Index is up 4.5% on the month-to-date basis and up over 30% for the year-to-date. So definitely some strong performance from the natural resource-based commodities here. And, you know, just looking across the screen here at some of the major components of the commodity basket here, you see a lot of green, which is very much different than what you're seeing in the equity and bond markets across these various commodities on the month-to-date and especially on the year-to-date basis. Right now, I only see three commodities that appear to be in the red for the year-to-date basis. A lot of that is, I'm just seeing greens and not just, you know, small positive prints. I'm talking about teens and some in the 30%, some in the 50%, some in the 90% higher on that front month contract. And I'm looking at heating oil right now. It's up 140% on that front month contract on a year-to-date basis. So that's been a little bit of a sneaky one. It's just kind of under the radar, but it's definitely a contributor to that positive return on the BCOM.
Yeah, well, I mean, looking at it, it's up 40, you know, on a spot price, it's up 40% on the week. So as you said, sneaky, but it was a huge pop this week.
Definitely. And then rounding that out, let's look at Bitcoin here. Dropped a little bit since just a couple minutes ago. It's now below 39,000, down 14. Let's call it down 15% on the month and down 16% on the year-to-date basis.
Yep. I mean, it certainly continues to be a good risk proxy. So, you know, it's down, you know, almost the same amount as the stock market.
Yeah. So not many places to hide at all, so far in 2022. I mean, you just have one little haven. I'm not going to use the word safe, but you have a little bit of a haven there in Kamais thus far, if you have held it coming into the year. But that's where we are in terms of the market through April 29th of this year. How did the things look in the macro front this week?
Yeah, on Tuesday, we got the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index. It was up 2.39% month over month. So, you know, that's a very large move there for a month over month number. The year over year number was up 20.2%. So this was well above expectations. Then you kind of had a lull there. Nothing really going on Wednesday. Thursday, we got the GDP number. That was a kind of surprise to the downside. It contracted 1.4%. So down 1.4% versus an expectation of an increase of 1.0%. And remember, the fourth quarter was a 6.9% number last year. Year over year, the GDP came in at 3.6% for the first quarter. So market didn't really seem to move too much on that number, even though it was a big disappointment. Really was kind of Ryan Kimmel, who kind of runs or is on part of our macro asset allocation team. His notes on the GDP number was that, one of the big disappointments there was that personal consumption came in much lower than expected, 2.7% versus a 3.5% consensus estimation. Consumption of goods declined during the quarter while services accelerated. But on the positive side, private investment contributed to growth during the quarter in non-residential investment. So really, it's kind of a mixed report. Exports were the big detractor, detracted 3.2% from GDP in the first quarter. Surprisingly, you don't get a quarterly contraction in GDP very often. And so surprisingly, kind of to me, the market didn't really move that much on that news. Today, we did get personal income and spending. Income was up 0.5%. Spending was up a whopping 1.1%, both of them above expectations. Income was expected to be up 0.4% and spending up 0.6%. So spending here, at least according to this metric, was accelerated much higher than expectations. And then we also got the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. The PCE deflator came out this morning. The headline number was a 6.6. It was below the 6.7 that was expected. So maybe people were taking a little bit of I wouldn't say a victory lap, but maybe a little victory jog from that number coming in below expectations. Core also came in a little bit below expectations at 5.2. Core now is below its peak. So if you look at the chart of the core PCE, maybe you look at that. We've peaked, and is it are we getting to a better place now in terms of that inflation number? But the headline number is still accelerating, still highest. Highest that we've seen. And the headline number was a 0.9% on a month over month basis, which was the highest since 2005. Now, it's something we've talked about back on January 7th of this year, episode 47, we discussed ECI. That number was, if you recall, Sam, in the November Fed meeting press conference, Jerome Powell said that the ECI number spooked him, and that was a 1.3% number for the third quarter of last year. It dropped to 1.0% for the fourth quarter, so everyone got a little bit more comfortable there. Well, it came out this morning, and it came in at 1.4%. It was expected to be 1.1, so much higher than expectations, higher than the last quarter, higher than the number when Powell got spooked. So really the market has started to price in some more Fed hikes coming out. Looks like we're getting closer to pricing in another 50 basis point hike in September. So market pricing in 50 in May, certainly, next week. So that's going to happen. We got a 50 in June. Actually, it's pricing in almost a 40% chance of a 75 in June. So we'll see how that works itself out after the May the 4th Fed meeting. Another 50 basis points in September. So market's starting to price in accelerated hikes at a pace that's much higher than the 25 that we had been accustomed to.
Yeah, based on this week's information, it'll be interesting to see how Powell talks about it, the impact of this negative quarter over quarter GDP on the back of some of these these higher costs, right? Both on the PCE and the cost employment cost index there. So definitely get the popcorn ready for that one.
Yep, it should be a fun one. Well, if we move over to the topic of the week this week, and Sam, we actually saw each other yesterday. We were in the office. I was in the office for a hot minute there to record we recorded a Channel 11 for Double Line with Ken Shinoda on commodities. And so we thought we've been getting a lot of questions on commodities. As you said, it was the loan of the major sectors or major sectors being positive on a year-to-date basis, up 30%+ for the BCOM. And so we've been getting a lot of questions on commodities. So why don't we give a quick rundown of kind of what we talked about yesterday for those of you that don't like to watch the videos, but I would highly encourage that when it comes out to watch the videos, because we have a lot of charts and we talked about a lot of the charts. And so the visuals would help versus only being an audio only medium like this podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the interest that we've been getting for commodities comes with the question, is it too late to buy commodities, right? It's funny how these things work, right? We've been talking about commodities with people for years now, and you usually don't get that type of interest in it prior to 2021. People are just like, why should I even own commodities at all? And at that time, we'd give them some of the more enduring reasons for why someone should own commodities in their portfolio. We talk about the diversification aspect of it. The fact that commodities have a low to negative correlation against the many of your traditional assets like fixed income and stocks there as well. And you know, we pointed it out at the start of the hour here, talking about how, you know, in the 60-40 world, if you had some commodities there, you'd be far better off than just the 60-40 split there. So having, you know, the diversification aspect is always important. It's investment 101, right? But people don't like things that when they're underperforming. So a lot of people were neglecting to look at commodities until, you know, this year, when they've already run up about, let's say, you know, 30% on a year-to-date basis. And, you know, over the last 2 years, it's up well over 100%. So you get some momentum chasers coming in here asking about it. But, you know, with that, It doesn't feel like it's too late. I mean, some of the stuff that we were talking about yesterday and we'll go through today, I mean, it just seems like you have some structural factors at play that are going to constrain supply. And also on the demand side, you have a somewhat newer driver of more structural demand, you know, that's going to last the next few decades if things go according to this, what people pledged within this climate treaty for the Paris Accords. But we can talk about that in a bit. But you know, you really have that setup where you could have commodities perform well over the longer term. So, you know, for those who are looking to add commodities for the first time, I like to say that it's, you know, we do have these tailwinds in play that could be supportive of positive commodity prices over the longer run. And from a diversification standpoint, it's never really too late to diversify your portfolio, right? I mean, if you're doing it to chase momentum, then you can talk about timing. But for diversification, it doesn't, I don't think there's really a time window to diversify your portfolio there. But with regards to some of the things that we're seeing here, you know, to get into the a little bit more of the specifics. I mean, if we look at it from the demand side, some of the near-term drivers of demand has just been the recovery since the 2020 pandemic. We've seen driving mobility has recovered to pre-pandemic levels, and that's certainly been supportive of the demand for gasoline and just petroleum-based products there. But one area that has yet to recover is air travel. It has quite a ways to go yet, but the trend is up as people are starting to emerge from their cocoons, and you're seeing both travel from vacationers, tourism, as well as business travel increasing up, but it still has a ways to go to get back to kind of those late 2019 levels. And I think that will continue to support that demand for petroleum-based products as people continue to increase their mobility. But then I already alluded to it, the longer run demand coming from this green energy revolution as well over 100 countries now have signed on to that Paris Agreement. But the key ones there, I mean, the big polluters out there in terms of the highest level of carbon emissions are the U.S. and China. Both of them have signed up. Recently we re-entered into the Paris Accord after we took a step away from it over the last 4 years or so. But that is certainly going to increase the consumption of these, of some of these energy source or energy-based like oil and gasoline again, but also industrial metals as those components are all requirements as inputs for the physical builds, and the energy side is the fuel for that growth engine to build out those products. But when we take a look at it, when we talk about renewable energy, you have things like solar and wind and electric vehicles, all of which are commodity intensive, especially from the industrial metals part of things. And when we look at the projections for where the electrical vehicle sales, for instance, are going, it's an ever increasing percentage of total vehicle sales. And what we've seen is that this growth as a percentage of sales, and with an estimated forecast of it, of electric vehicles to overtake internal combustion engines vehicles by sometime in the 30s, 2030s, let's call it by 2035, over 50% of all vehicle sales are expected to be to take place within the electrical vehicle market. So along with those vehicles, you also have to build out the infrastructure for charging these vehicles. So on top of that, again, these are all highly commodity intensive endeavors for both the electrical vehicles as well as kind of the electricity generation component through solar and wind. But one of the charts that we showed yesterday, and that was pretty interesting to me, is just using copper as an example and how what the requirements are for your typical cars by vehicle types. And your typical internal combustion engine vehicle takes around 20 to 40 pounds of copper per car. If you look at the full battery electric vehicles, and that's not your Prius, those are hybrids, but let's just talk about something that's more like your Model S or your Teslas there. Those full battery electric vehicles, they require 180 pounds of copper. And that's almost the same amount of copper that's required from a hybrid electric bus, which takes 200 pounds of copper per vehicle there. But if we're talking about truly getting to carbon neutrality, then if we're looking at battery electric buses, that requires over 800 pounds of copper. So definitely you can see how these are very commodity intensive endeavors in order to build out these green energy projects here. And that's led a number of analysts and researchers out there to estimate, and it seems like they do converge somewhere around $1.5 trillion in infrastructure spending needs per year in order to get to net zero by 2050. And again, that 2050 is the goal that the country signed and pledged to reach in terms of carbon neutrality through that Paris Agreement.
That's right. And I think, you make a good point there. That's all on the demand side. If we look at the supply side of things, we showed some charts of, inventories and, Sam, you and I talked about nickel for a long time. When the LME shut down trading of nickel, and how the LME has very low inventories of nickel, and that's kind of what drove a lot of the short squeeze. But looking at nickel, aluminum, copper, zinc, all of them have the same look very, very similar in terms of the amount of inventory they have being very low. And when we talk about copper and how electric vehicles are going to need so much copper, and as you said, by 2035, which is coming up a lot sooner than you think, really to get that much of copper out of the ground and into usable, into a usable state, it really takes a long time for those copper mines to, get up and running. And if we're at low inventories now, we really should start producing more copper, getting those copper mines going now. If we're going to try to meet that sort of demand by 2035. And so, looking at the supply, looking at we had a chart showing the Chilean copper production, it's near its five-year low. Chile is the, I think they're the largest producer of copper in the world. I think they account for about a third of global copper production. So with them and their production near five-year lows, you know, when we look at industrial metals, we look at the price charts, really, we think that there's a lot of upside there in terms of those prices, just because low supply, low production, largely increased, you know, if we kind of go down this net zero emissions type policy, that you're going to see a lot more demand for copper. And I guess maybe at some point you could get to a place where copper becomes so expensive that you start to use some substitutes. You know, copper is a very, obviously it's used as a very good conductor. So at some point, maybe you have to use you start to use silver as a conductor if it, if your precious metals don't move, and copper keeps rising in price, then maybe you start having some silver in your cars.
Yeah, if that goes on, then maybe gold, right? So one of the things that perked up Kimbrough's ears, but silver definitely would be the alternative. But let's not forget too that silver is a key component of solar panels, right? So for that solar generation of renewable energy, that's a key component there as well. So, you know, you're talking about the kind of the life cycle of copper mining, right? I mean, on the shortest end in terms of a time window, in terms of when they can go from approval of additional mining to the exploration to find where and take a stab at where, you know, the copper might be, down to the build out of the mines and to finally the extraction of that raw copper from the ground, it the quickest I've seen is, you know, 10 years. The longest I've seen is 25, but on for the most part, people say it takes around 15 years for that all in. So, you know, we've seen that the amount of capex decline since its peak around 2012, you know, coming into where we are now in 2022, it's starting to pick up a little bit. But from some of the news that I've been reading, some of the pickup in capex isn't really for newer mines, it's just for the maintenance of existing mines. So if we're looking to ramp up the production of copper, you know, things got to start moving fairly quickly, and we'll still be on that, you know, let's call it 15-year lag before, you know, you go from approval to extraction.
Yeah, so that's doesn't bode well for increased copper production, at least over the short term.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, we've seen a similar type of dynamic in the energy side of things as well, with oil drilling and just the amount of, or the lack of, let's say, investment in the capital expenditure and maintenance of the existing wells there. But it's a similar type theme, and we're at multi-year lows, in some case decade type of lows, when it comes to total crude inventories. You know, we had a chart on there that showed the total crude inventories here in the U.S., including that of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And currently where we're at is we're at the lowest levels going back to 2005. And when you look at the trend of that build, seasonality is incredibly important, because, you know, the first half of the calendar year is important for storage build as we enter into summer peak driving months. But in 2022, so far, it's been the other way around, and we've seen the trend of inventory draws and the inventory decline over this period of time. So that doesn't bode well for the what types of prices we might be seeing at the gas pumps coming, let's say, around Memorial Day, when people really start to kick off their summer driving months. This is on top of, you know, the various releases that are projected to come from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, not only here in the U.S., but across other developed market countries as well. And we've seen that similar theme where across other countries, this is some of the lowest levels as well for their versions of the government Strategic Petroleum Reserves. All in, this has led us to the lowest stocks, kind of the number, this the lowest inventory to use type of ratios that we've seen in decades as well. So some of these things are, like we've been saying, is going to be a little bit tough to cure, in terms of just, you can't just print out the supply of oil. You can't just print out the supply of copper, right? You
know, that's right.
We're going to see with Jay and, you know, what you know, how that money printer is going to work on next week's meeting, but you certainly can't do that with real assets, real physical assets here.
Yeah, and one of the charts that Jason put together for us for the Channel 11 shows the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And if we go through with this 30 million barrel drawdown a month for 6 months, that gets us back to, you know, 1984 type levels when we were just building up the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And you know, that doesn't, you know, if we do get some sort of price shock here in oil over the short term, it's not like the SPR can release more oil to kind of keep things under control. So kind of in a tight bind there in terms of looks like, you know, at least over the short to medium term in terms of energy prices. And if we get a demand pickup, which, you know, maybe the Fed is trying to slow things down so that demand slows down, and could have been, you know, I wouldn't say they were happy about the negative GDP print for the first quarter, but at least maybe that assuages a little bit of their demand on their concern about the demand side of things.
Yeah. And we also, I mean, it sounds great to say that you're just going to release the strategic petrol barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but let's not forget that you also have to replenish that supply. Or I guess you don't have to, but if you want it to work the way it's intended to work in order to act as a buffer for oil shocks, then you should look to replenish it. And, you know, so far it hasn't looked great. And we've been slowly drawing the SPR down, going back to, it looks like around 2010. And there's very few occasions where they actually rebuild the stock. So from the highs of, let's say back in early 2010 or late, let's say around 2008 or so, it got as high as 727 million barrels. And I think that's where the cap is in terms of where it is. But now since then, through 2022, it's been on a fairly steady draw down to where we are today at around 550 barrels. And then you throw on that additional 180. I mean, at some point this needs to be restocked, right? And the question is at what prices. Hopefully it's not at higher prices than where we are now, right? Which would incrementally draw up the price of WTI crude as the government steps in to buy again.
Yeah, but I think that looking at the fundamentals, it's gonna be hard to see oil prices going down significantly. You know, I guess there's always the chance once you get a negative print in oil, there's always a chance of the prices going down.
Yeah, and we've seen it go as high as 150 bucks a barrel, you know, pre-GFC. So sometime around 2008, I think, is where it peaked out. And if you think about the amount of inflation that's come in the consumer price baskets over that time, you know, you've actually seen deflation in WTI crude oil. So there's definitely a lot of room for it to make up ground here from where we're at today at around 106 bucks a barrel.
Yeah, I think I saw an estimate that said WTI needs to get to, you know, $225 a barrel or so to kind of get to the same, you know, same effect on the economy as it did at 150 pre-crisis. So, you know, could double from here.
Yeah. And those are some of the longer term, you know, structural drivers that we're talking about of both supply and demand. But, you know, we've had, unfortunately, some recent geopolitical event risk that has propelled certain commodities higher. And, you know, what we're talking about again, of course, is the war in Ukraine. But Russia and Ukraine are the primary, in aggregate, are the primary exporters of grain, accounting for 30% of total wheat global exports and 20% of the corn global exports. So definitely, you know, the prices that increases that we've seen at the grocery store may not stop, you know, here. So it could continue to rise based on that. And then on the energy front, Russia's one of the top three producers of crude oil. Typically Saudi Arabia and Russia vie for second place after the U.S. now, which is now the largest producer of crude oil. But on the natural gas front, they're second, you know, right after the U.S. So, you know, we've seen it in the news. We've talked about it here in Monday Morning Minutes, but Europe is highly dependent on Russia for natural gas, amongst other things. But as a whole, somewhere around 40% of Europe's total natural gas imports come from Russia. So that's definitely putting a bind on things for people living across the pond from us.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, certainly over the, you know, hopefully over the short term, as the conflict dies down, or, you know, if it's an extended conflict, how that works, especially, you know, as we talked about yesterday, as, you know, as the weather picks up here in the Northern Hemisphere, as it gets warmer, Europe will be less, you know, they won't need as much natural gas. But as it gets cold again, how are they going to deal with that? And maybe that's why we've seen some prices of heating oil rise so much here recently, as people were trying to stockpile some sources of heating for the winter months.
That's right. So, well, hopefully everyone found this somewhat interesting. If you did and you want to learn more, be sure we'll let you know when that episode of Channel 11 comes out. I think we recorded for about 45 minutes or so just on commodities alone, and we have a lot of great charts, as Mayberry said. So, and then you can also see Kenny if you haven't seen them before. Right. You should know that our portfolio manager and the heads up our non-agency mortgage-backed securities team here at Double Line. So, Jeff, do you want to let our listeners know what they should be keeping an eye on for next week?
Yeah, next week is a pretty busy week. On Monday, we get the ISM manufacturing number for April. It's estimated to come in at 58.0 versus the 57.1 last month. So that's continues to be bullish. We get the JOLTS job openings for March on Tuesday. That number was last 11.266 million. So we'll see how that shakes itself out here. And if you remember, Jay Powell has been talking about the number of job openings per unemployed person as being very high, and wanted to bring that number more in, more in line or in better balance. So keep an eye on that JOLTS number. Wednesday, if we get the ISM services number for April, that's expected to be 59.0 versus 58.3 last month. But of course, the big news on Wednesday, May the 4th, is the Fed meeting, 50 basis point hike fully priced in. The question is, what do we get from the balance sheet reduction? Do we get it? Does it start in May? Do they kind of ease how fast they get to the caps? Is there some, we had some discussion yesterday on whether the caps are actually caps or are they targets? So something like if mortgages prepays remain slow, do they sell to hit the cap? Or is it just if the prepayments pick up and they come in higher than the cap, do they just buy down to that cap? So still a lot of nuance left to go. And I'm sure that the press conference will just be all balance sheet all the time. So again, we'll tune in with our popcorn again and see how Jay handles things. And then on Friday, the real Pizza Friday, we get non-farm payroll numbers. That number expected to be 390,000. That was 431,000 last month. So still a solid number. But not as high as we've been experiencing over the past few months. The U3 unemployment is expected to be flat at 3.6%. U6 underemployment was 6.9% last month. They don't usually give an expectation for that, but just keep in mind 6.9%. And then labor force participation rate is expected to increase, which is good, to 62.5% from 62.4%. So a little bit of a tick there. So a lot going on next week. I expect a pretty volatile week going into the just around the Fed and how things go from the Fed. But at least we had a no Fed speak this past week to have a little bit of a calmer Fed expectations market.
Yeah, we'll have to bring out the tomes for next Wednesday, I suppose. But it'll be interesting to see. And you mentioned the real Pizza Friday. I was here for this fake Pizza Friday, aka the new Pizza Thursdays yesterday. And I have to say the pizza was the same, but it just didn't have the same feel. So I'm participating, definitely wasn't didn't have the same sizzle, let's say. They didn't have the herd of, I think it's the lack of competition also. It's like you don't have that herd of individuals coming from our U.S. corporate credit team that just always swarm the pizza, yep, like locusts before anyone else can get there. So it used to be fun where we tried to get the early look and strategically be in place before just as the pizza was arriving.
Yeah, Michelle used to give us the heads up.
That's right. Well, she gave me the heads up yesterday. Oh.
So but we were on a call, so it didn't matter. Couldn't leave. All right. Well, I think that's good. And that wraps it up for this week, Sam. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for continuing to listen to us today. If you're a first time listener, don't forget to subscribe to Monday Morning Minutes so you don't miss an episode. You can pick up each episode before on Monday before the bell at any of your favorite podcast platforms, or you can, if you're not finding it, or if you have any questions, you have any comments, you have any hate, you have any love, you know, shoot us an email at minutes@doubleline.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter at @DLineMinutes to send us your questions.
Yeah, and if you hate Sam's mic, don't send it in. He's working on a subpar setup today. Actually being in the office is a subpar setup from doing it at home. You can find more information about DoubleLine at our website, doubleline.com. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/DoubleLineCapital, where you can shortly check out our appearance on Channel 11. Don't forget to subscribe to Sam's other podcast, The Sherman Show, which we just released yesterday. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but the highly anticipated crypto pod came out yesterday. So Mark, if you're still listening, hopefully the answer to your question from months ago now should find some interest in that podcast. You can follow Sam and Jeff Sherman on Twitter at Sherman Show Pod. Hope everyone has a great week.
Thanks, everyone, and good luck out there.
This audio presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media in any form without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media at doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Liability, including in respect of direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is expressly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice in this podcast. The receipt of this podcast by the listener is not to be taken as constituting the giving of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual to that listener, nor to constitute such person or a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but does not imply low risk. Securities mentioned are not a recommendation or solicitation to buy or sell. These securities were chosen based on their active overweights within the representative portfolio to explain portfolio positioning and the forward-looking view of the market that drives such positioning. For the preceding year, beginning August 24th, 2021, a list of all positions is available by request at media@doubleline.com. Equities may decline in value due to both real and perceived general market, economic, and industry conditions.